I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday at the Movies. Movie mavens Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post are here with what to see in movie theaters this weekend. Beauty and the Beast is a hit. Ghost in a Shell, it's a ghost bust. Plus, young film directors often make horror movies to make their mark in Hollywood. We'll talk about how films like Get Out and Raw push the barriers of the genre, plus your favorite slasher flicks and monster movies. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Los Otros at the Everyman Theater. But first, the Midday Movie Mayhem coming up after the news. Don't listen alone.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
And welcome. It's the Midday Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall with my two favorite mayhemists sitting here. They're the chemists of mayhem, which we call mayhemists. Anne Hornaday is a film critic for the Washington Post and the author of the upcoming book, Talking Pictures.
That is correct.
I now have a chance to go on
well
to the grand prize, the grand prize round. And Jed Dietz, the very busy director of the Maryland Film Festival. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So we want to start today by talking about horror movies. And Jed, you may be living a horror movie for all I know, because when I drive by the Stavros Niarchos Parkway Foundation Theater, or Foundation Parkway Theater,
right,
it doesn't look finished.
It's not, Tom.
It's not finished. And it's supposed to be finished in like 20 days or something.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so he sounds calm, ladies and gentlemen, but let me report
too,
that there is sweat dripping down his face all over the table here in Studio A. I mean, it's always a crunch to the finish, isn't it?
It's amazing. I mean, obviously, I've never been through one of these projects before, but the team, Zigger Sneed and the Southway, you know, the contractors and
Zigger Sneed's the architecture firm that did it.
And then Seawall Development, which has done all this great work around the city and Remington and stuff, or our project managers, Evan Morville from them, is doing it. And they're just working so beautifully together. I mean, right now, you're right. I mean, it is. I was there yesterday, and it's like a ballet. You know, you're moving people in and out of a booth, and you're going to get a painter out, and then the electrician goes in, and then the projection guy goes in. You know, we're still waiting on seats in one of the theaters. We've got seats installed in two of the three.
Those usually help a theater. The theatrical experience quite a bit. It's been my experience that, you know, when you have to stand through, you know, a three-hour movie, that's hard.
It's been done, but it's a little difficult. Yeah, and the seats are fantastic. And we've got little fold-out tables in the small theaters. We've got these beautiful seats that are going to go in this incredible 1915 historic theater. It's, you know, and we're and the whole concept of letting the 100 years of movie history be seen to everybody, and all the layers and all the paint and all the texture and how the movie industry itself has evolved since 1915. It you know, played only silent films for the first 12 or 14 years of its life, and had a tea room. You know, who knew you needed a tea room for a movie theater?
Yeah. Yeah, well, so it's going to be fun. And we have an event. We'll talk a little bit more about it when we finish up today. But on Friday, April 28th, we're going to have a special live broadcast of the Midday Movie Mayhem from the Parkway.
Yeah, it'll be
and
really
so,
cool.
Folks, if you'd like to join us and be part of that audience, you can come to our website, WIPR.org, and we'll have a link to where you can get tickets and stuff. It's free, but you need a ticket to reserve your seat to make sure that we don't have too many people. But we hope that you'll join us, and we're going to have a filmmaker. We're going to have some folks from the MICA filmmaking program, the Hopkins filmmaking program. We're going to have Steve Zigger, who's the architect who designed the building. We're going to have all sorts of folks, and you guys, of course.
Yep.
So I want to talk
about The Mayhemists.
The Mayhemists will be in the house.
Our mayhem
you will
magic.
Christen it with
our
your mayhem
mojo.
That's
yes.
it. So this thing about horror movies, it came to our attention because, I mean, this movie by Jordan Peele, Get Out, which is very funny in a lot of ways, but it's also, it really is a horror movie. It's got a large message, very interesting and complex message, I think. And then there's this movie Raw.
Yeah.
So Anne, I mean, tell us a little bit about, we talked about Get Out. I mean, and, mm-hmm. and this is this whole, you know, commentary about race in America mm-hmm. and a lot of stuff.
And but, continues to be a huge hit. I mean, it's just huge. Totally yeah. surprising everybody.
Right. I mean, you know, no one had any
idea. It's the
story
of the year
yeah.
so far.
Yeah.
In terms and it may of, end up being the story of the year.
In terms of money.
At
yeah,
the
yeah,
end
yeah,
of the year. Yeah.
yeah. And good for him. I mean, he's just a brilliant guy.
Thrilling.
He's just a brilliant guy. I mean, Key and Peele, I said this before, I think it was the best show ever put mm-hmm. on a television screen ever. But Raw is, from what I understand, a very gross, violent
yes.
movie, right? And I'm not a horror movie aficionado, yeah. But horror movies really are, I guess, an entree for a lot of folks into yes. the film business.
Well, yeah. and it was at Cannes. I would just, you know, you described it correctly, but it then premiered at Cannes. It just,
right.
So it had that provenance already.
Yeah, yeah. artsy.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, I've watched the Get Out trajectory with great interest and happiness. And, you know, in that mix, we also have the new night, we were talking off before the show started about M. Night Shyamalan, and he has a new movie called Split that is one of the biggest hits of the year, which isn't even one of his best movies in my humble estimation. But horror as a genre is just one of the most enduring ways for filmmakers to get messages across, to weave in allegory. And it's, as you said, it's a wonderful way for especially first-time and emerging filmmakers to make movies cheaply. You can do things on the cheap. You don't need stars because the genre is the star. And it always
ketchup
gets...
Ketchup is inexpensive.
Exactly, or Hershey's
yeah.
syrup, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And frankly, you know, the lower the budget, as the Blair Witch guys taught us years ago, the more inventive you have to be and the more creative you are and the better the movie is. And so all of those things, you know, that Hollywood tells us they need to make movies are completely unnecessary for the genre, for the horror genre. And it's allowed some really wonderful filmmakers to make their mark. I mean, one of the best movies of last year was The Witch by Robert Eggers, you know, who just, you know, again, with very few resources, delivered so much production value and so much visual beauty and
an incredible
really
movie.
Genuinely scary, thoughtful, strange film. We've had movies in the past few years called, like The Babadook and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night by female filmmakers who are, you know, again, the genres allowing otherwise marginalized groups to be able to work and to make their, you know, make these calling card films. And It Follows would be, I think, another example of that. But the interesting thing is that Peele is continuing this tradition of political allegory, like a George Romero might have done, you know, with Night of the Living Dead. This new movie, Raw, which is by a French filmmaker, Julia Mangle. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. It's very much in that kind of body horror tradition. And by body horror, I just mean really doing gross things to the human and other, in this case, animal bodies that just push the envelope in terms of tolerance of the audience. But there is an audience for that. They're not just base, you know. Their desires aren't just base. They're really looking at it as an art form.
A theater in Los Angeles was giving away customized barf bags.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's the big, yeah. And you know, which also harkens back to a great cinematic tradition of Ballyhoo and, you know, hype.
New Dimensions of 3D.
Yeah, they gave out barf bags at the press screening. And, you know, I think she's getting at issues of female sexuality and empowerment. To me, it's not nearly as smart or fully realized as Get Out was, but, you know, I think it kind of stumbles at the end. But it's very artfully done, and there's no disputing her filmmaking chops.
So I want to ask our audience, if you guys have seen, guys and women, have seen Get Out, if you've seen Raw, we'd love to know what you think about it. And also I want to put out a question for you and a chance to go on to our grand prize round, which we'll answer for you in the second segment of today's show. What is the highest grossing horror movie of all time? Right, so you are welcome to give us a call and throw in your suggestion for the highest grossing horror movie of all time.
Is this open book, Mike?
This is you can be open book.
I mean,
if you want to call Uncle Google, that's, you know, if you don't want to do it in a sort of, you know, credible way, you go ahead and cheat. I don't care. 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. That's our number for the Midday Movie Mayhem. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So Jed, when a filmmaker makes a horror movie, does he or she risk being stereotyped or, you know, pigeonholed as a horror movie maker? I mean, I think of a local guy, Chris LaMartina, mm-hmm. who's made three or four mm-hmm. pretty interesting horror movies.
And Don Dollar.
And he really likes mm-hmm. it. I mean, he's going to keep making horror movies. So yep. I don't think he's, like, doing these so that he can make some chick flick or, you know, something. I guess it's no longer the case that people are getting stereotyped, and it's not impeding their career in any way.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think it sort of depends on what the filmmaker is looking forward to. And another local, he's not around anymore, he passed away, but Don Dollar was in the genre quite happily, you know, and I think he had an insurance business on the side and had quite a successful career very much in horror genre and sort of really going to very specific audiences and trade shows around it and stuff like that. But, you know, John Carpenter and, I mean, others have launched careers. M. Night is another one who, you know, are seen beyond that genre for sure and are great big players in the Hollywood world. So
I think Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele for sure.
Yeah, he's announced his intentions to branch out and do a lot of different genres. He'll I think he's being in talks now to do the adaptation of Akira, which is another anime adventure story.
And the question always comes out, because I think about this, like in terms of filmmakers like Quentin Tarantino, mm-hmm. and though there's so much gratuitous violence, mm-hmm. what seems to me to be gratuitous mm-hmm. violence in his movies, and I hate it. I mean, I'm not a horror movie guy. I'm never buying a ticket to Raw in my life. If someone invites me to Raw, you know, I'm going to schedule a root canal. I'm waiting for Cooked. Absolutely. But
overdone.
I mean, the question, question is, you know, can't they say it without the gratuitous violence? Can't they make their point? Can't they delve into the allegory without this? I mean, why does, Mademoiselle Ducournau, the French-Belgian filmmaker of Raw, why does she need that?
Well, this is a topic that I've explored many times in my writing, and because I'm not a violence fan either, but it is they are reaching back to a grindhouse exploitation B movie tradition, which is very much where Quentin is, and that's where Robert Rodriguez lives, you know, and they just have it. There's enormous pleasure in it, and I don't get pleasure from it, and you don't, but a lot of people do. And it's not, like I said, it's not necessarily because they're awful people. It's because they see an artfulness to it. They get a catharsis from it. It's funny. I have this kind of ongoing email relationship with one of my readers who's seems like a very civilized woman up in Silver Spring who always takes me to task for being so squeamish about violence. And she's like, I like it, you know, and so you just never know with people. I mean, some people really get a lot out of it.
I remember being at the first screening of Reservoir Dogs at Sundance. So Tarantino wasn't Tarantino yet. And, you know, it's a fantastic film, I think, but lots of violence, including sort of torture scene and stuff like that. And as the movie ended, a guy leapt to his feet. And, you know, here's Tarantino at 25 or whatever he was, working in a video store. And this guy started yelling at him. He said, how dare you make a movie like this? 300 people got shot on the streets of Los Angeles, blah, blah, blah. And Tarantino was like sort of reeling from this attack and said, I didn't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. And
it's a movie.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, that's the sort of the thing that the artist gets into. And is there a cathartic? I mean, that's the argument. You know, it's sort of like sex in movies. You know, is there a catharsis? Is there an outlet for people, or is it dangerous? And I don't think we actually know the answer to that question. But
Paulie sends us an email, says, horror is the best conduit for social and cultural commentary. Two of my favorite movies in recent years are from the same director, Jeremy Saulnier.
Oh, I was going to thank you. Thank you so much.
The two movies that Paulie mentions are
exactly.
Blue Ruin
wonderful.
And
yes.
Green Ruin.
Yes,
yep.
Thank you.
Beautiful, moving, and scary.
Very well said. And I was so glad you brought them up, because I was going to mention that, because that's another one where They also use, I say they because he's collaborated with his childhood friend Macon Blair, who delivers really a just an astonishing performance in Blue Ruin. He's the lead character and has made his own little movie that we're going to talk about later.
But what about this assertion that it's the best conduit for social and cultural commentary? I mean, there are a lot of people making terrific cultural comments in their movies
usually,
that aren't horror movies.
But it's usually in a genre. Like, look at Hell or High Water. They used Western. Look at Arrival. That used sci-fi. I mean, genre itself is an excellent conduit for social commentary. I would actually love to see a little bit more realist drama take it on, you know? I mean, I kind of miss that. That was the old 70s style social issue movies like Network and All the President's Men. I would like to see a few more of those. But no, I do think that horror... and especially really stylized hyperbolic horror, like look at Django to bring back Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people took issue with his use of that vernacular to address racism and the history of slavery. But actually, I actually thought it was a really interesting visual language and emotional language to get at pathology.
I agree.
And insanity. And you almost need something that heightened and that... that outsized to get at the truth of something.
And Jordan Peele is the, you know, is the son of a multiracial couple. He could have easily made a documentary about what it was like growing up in a privileged white liberal world as an identified black man. And, you know, it would have grossed $1 million maybe because he would have made a good movie. He's a really talented guy and been at Sundance and all that stuff. This thing is Get Out, which
this is like $100 million.
Over $100 million. I mean, yeah.
And counting, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So,
well, good for him.
Yep.
All right. It's the Midday Movie Mayhem. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, it's the Midday News Wrap. Senator Chris Van Hollen's going to join me. He'll give us his take on the Gorsuch nomination, the Russian investigation, and other stories in the news. I'll also talk to Domenico Montanaro. He's NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience, as well as Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. When we come back today, we'll have more with Ann Hornaday and Jed Dietz. We'd love to hear your guess or your conclusion as to the highest grossing horror movie of all time, and also hear from you about your favorite horror movies and, you know, flicks that make you flinch. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Here's Johnny.
I see dead people.
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
No.
They're here.
Oh, yes. There will be blood.
Helen, I came for you.
I'm every nightmare you ever had. I am your worst dream come true. I'm everything you ever were afraid of.
Producer Bridget Armstrong giving us a tour of her DVD library.
Well done.
Appreciate that. If you've just joined us, I'm Tom Hall. It's the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem. Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, joins me here in Studio A along with Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post. Ann's new book is due out in June. It's called Talking Pictures. We're talking horror pictures in particular. I'm interested in your guess as to the highest grossing horror film of all time. Highest grossing horror film of all time. We talked a little bit about Raw. We talked a little bit about Get Out. I understand they're going to remake the movie It, which was a horror movie from back in the day. Is that the one about the clowns? Do I have that right? Yeah, it's about the... Yeah, it's a whole series about clowns and stuff. So they're doing it. So the horror... I mean, now, the audience for this, I would assume, Jed, is teenage boys, right?
And girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
are these date movies?
As somebody with intimate experience, they love this stuff. I mean, and it's people are always worried about young people going to the movies, and are they going to stop going to the theater because they're so addicted to their phones? And I can attest to the fact that yes, they will go to get out of the house and get away from their parents. There will always be a place, you know. There will always be a place for theaters as a refuge from domestic oppression for teenagers. And they're just in that sweet spot of life where they're seeking a safe place to explore danger. And you know, there's no better way to just take yourself to the edge of fright and terror and sensation and emotion. I mean, you know, it's just that's my personal hypothesis as to why this is an enduring art form.
Well, we have some folks who are chiming in with an answer to the trivia question. Patrick in Chestertown, welcome to the Movie Mayhem. What's your guess?
Well, I wanted to ask first if it was considering adjusted for inflation or just the raw numbers.
Well, give us. Do you have an answer for both?
Yeah, for just raw numbers, I think it might be The Sixth Sense.
The Shyamalan movie. All right.
Yeah, and for adjusted for inflation, I was thinking Jaws.
All right. I'm going to take a few more answers, and then we will announce what the actual answer is.
The other measure I would point out would be return on investment, which
that's
is
a
calculation often made in the film world, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in other words, what it costs to make versus
the gross.
All right. That would be profitability.
Well, Patrick, those are two very good stabs at it. I appreciate it, and I don't use the word stab lightly in this conversation. Rebecca in Baltimore, welcome to the Movie Mayhem.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I want to say I'm a huge fan of Jed Dietz and the Maryland Film Festival, and can't wait to read your book.
Oh, thank
just
you.
Real quick as an insight, because I, too, like you all, I don't like violent movies. But when we were doing our exhibition, What Makes Us Smile, I had a whole section on why Halloween and amusement parks with really scary rides and monster flicks are so very, you know, popular. And there was an interesting study. Can I remember what it was? I could look it up. But that they looked at the blood of people watching hilarious movies, movies that were making them, you know, incontinent with laughter. And then they looked at the hormonal changes and blood chemistry changes when people were watching horror films, not the ones that are very cruel, but like where, you know, kind of like there's a safe level of non-plausibility in it. And they found out that the blood reaction to both the comic and the scary were identical.
Huh.
And that was very insightful to me because what I was thinking is, you know how little kids, you go like, and they run away and then they come back and say, play more monster. And they can do this over and over again. But if you were really somebody who was intending harm to that child, even intuitively, a small child wouldn't be coming running back to say, oh, play monster more or scare me more.
Yeah, they get it.
You know, right.
They get it.
Yeah. All right, Rebecca, thank you for your call. That's Rebecca Hofberger. She's the founder of AVAM, the American Visionary Art Museum. They got a great exhibition going on there as we speak. You should head down and check it out. Thank you for the call. Tiffany in Baltimore, what's your guess as to the highest grossing horror movie of all time?
Oh, that was so easy. It has to be The Sixth Sense now.
Okay, so we got another vote for The Sixth Sense. Well, thank you for your call, Tiffany. I appreciate it. So far we got Patrick and Tiffany going with The Sixth Sense. Mike in Salisbury, welcome to the Movie Mayhem. What's your take?
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for having me on. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I actually was a former projectionist at Baltimore. And my guess is The Shining, although I doubt that it wins. I want it to.
Stay strong, Mike.
I'm trying here. But actually, I voiced an opinion about a question that I'm not sure if I can really get an objective answer out of Jed since he's opening a theater now, but trying to get a feel for what you guys see for the future of film exhibition in the city of Baltimore. Since when I left projection in 2009, we have seen a huge change in the landscape of film and theatrical exhibitions within the city of Baltimore in terms of clearance between theaters, plus obviously the Cusacks dealing with the Senator, and now that we have the Cinebistro up in Hamden opened, you know, it seemed like 10 years ago the opening of the Landmark Theater in Harbor East was a really big deal, but now I'm not hearing a whole lot of dialogue about what, you know, the future of film exhibition in Baltimore is, especially when it seems like per theater revenue is down.
Oh, that's a good question. You mentioned the Cusacks there, the folks who own the Charles Theater and the Center.
And the Center, yeah, did such a great job at restoring both and opening them up to the public, you know, keeping the Senator in a really important mode because it was a great 1939 movie theater.
But rare, I guess your bet with the Parkway Theater is that the rising tide lifts all the boats, right?
Well,
because it is yet another place to see movies.
Yeah, and we're fortunate in the city now. We're way under screen statistically. I mean, if you just on a per capita basis. But what has been now is in the city, which for many years wasn't, thanks to the Cusacks and the Landmark. Our studio movies are now playing in the city, so that's great. The Charles obviously does a fantastic job with mainstream art house. The part that nowhere in the area has been served are these emerging filmmaker films like we show at the festival and at Sundance and Cannes. And many of them never come back to Baltimore. If they came here at all. And so that's what the Parkway, I mean, we're a not-for-profit, so we can afford to do it. It's a much smaller theater, and that's what we'll fill it with.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's a very good question. It's something I've been looking at. And you mentioned the Cine Bistro, which is in my neighborhood, and I still haven't had a chance to go, and I'm very eager to. It's very, we did try to go one night, and the show we wanted to see was sold out, because I'm assuming that they're auditoriums are probably pretty small.
Yeah, 60 seats.
But it was just beautiful, and it was so packed. The bar area, this is one of those, the Alamo Draft House has really really perfected this approach, but there's a bar, and you can have food served to you at your table in the theater, and it kind of combines movie watching with the whole dining and drinking and sociability experience. And it really does look like it could be a wonderful community gathering place. It's unfortunate you have to be 21 or over to go because of the bar license, which is too bad for the families in the neighborhood. We were kind of hoping for a more, you know,
yeah, can't go out for a family dinner and see some.
Not to this theater, but yeah. I think it is an example of what theater owners feel impelled to do in order to preserve their business, which is to provide comfortable seats, provide high-end food and drink, make sure the concessions are top flight. I mean, I think they're really focusing much more on that 360 experience in order to make it worth people's while to rest themselves away from peak TV and their iPad and their phones and everything else that's competing for those dollars.
Yeah, and there's so much you can do in the privacy of your own home.
Exactly. But then again, you know, the reason why horror endures is because that's another genre that really needs to be seen with a group. I mean, and that's another reason why people go out to theaters to see it.
Right, because the audience gasps and the audience
screams. It's no fun at all if you're just at home alone.
Yeah.
And I thought Rebecca made such a brilliant point about the laughter. And when I saw Raw with the audience, at the most disturbing points, I noticed a lot of people laughed because it's a way to express tension. And it's one way to kind of process all of that. And so it's very interesting, that close relationship between the two feelings.
Yeah.
You do a concert and people say they laughed, they cried.
You
make
a
movie like this, they laughed, they cried, they threw up.
I don't
understand.
Exactly.
All right, so Tom writes from Baltimore on an email, "I think we inoculate ourselves by going to horror movies. We go through artificial horror in order to convince ourselves that we'll be able to handle the real horrors that wait around the corner, especially for those of us who live in super protected environments like gated suburbs, etc. It seems that some scaring is necessary." Good comment from Tom Chalkley, a terrific member of
the
We
Tom
do.
Hall.
And Tom Chalkley's been in the media landscape in this town for a long time. So thank you for that call or that email. Here's Frank, who says, "I remember seeing at the Parkway the musical Pajama Tops with Elaine Stritch back in the day."
Wow.
And he says, "In 1964 or so, my wife and I attended a movie at the Lowe's Parkway." Mm-hmm. And he says, "At 84 plus years, I can't remember the name. It was a dark and stormy night. It was raining so hard that I ran to get the car in a downpour to chivalrously pick her up. I drove onto the sidewalk under the large, commodious canopy to the safety of a dry location." Frank, you are a great date. You are a great date. Well, thank you very much for that email. I appreciate it. We have one more entry into our sweepstakes to guess the highest grossing horror movie of all time. Vincent in Montgomery County, welcome to Midday and the Movie Mayhem. Hey, Vincent, are you there? We have lost Vincent, although I understand from highly placed sources that his guess is The Exorcist. Right?
So far,
we've got Patrick saying The Sixth Sense. We've got Tiffany saying The Sixth Sense, and we've got Mike saying The Shining, and Vincent, were he able to get through on our phone system, would say The Exorcist. So,
wow.
Drum roll, please. Ba 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 bump. The answer is M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. Now, however, it is the highest grossing horror movie of all time. Film raked in over $670 million worldwide. That's a lot of dough. Mm. But it's a little misleading because if you adjust for inflation, our smart listeners have done that, The Exorcist and Jaws actually made more money.
Okay.
Oh. Right? 1973, The Exorcist came out. Still one of the most valuable horror movies. You know, the franchise of The Exorcist just keeps on. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Mm. It's so far grossed $1.145 billion.
Wow.
Billions with a B.
Yeah.
That's a lot of dope.
That is indeed.
I will never forget seeing The Exorcist. It was 1973. It was my freshman year in college. Mm. I came home for Christmas vacation, and these
terrifying
two friends of mine, two girls, said, "You got to take us to see The Exorcist. We're afraid to go ourselves." And I didn't know what an exorcism was. I thought it was like extortion.
I
thought it was extortion. It was going to be some like blackmail
right.
movie. I mean, and this is a Catholic kid from Jersey, and I had missed the exorcism memo. So we go, and one sits on one side, and the other sits on the other side. By the end of the movie, both of my arms were maimed because they had crunched their fingernails into both of my arms. And I was terrified. I was convinced that I was occupied by a demon for like a month after. I would like look in the mirror to make sure I didn't have horns growing out of my head. It was awful. I mean, and then years later, my daughter decides to attend Georgetown University. And we go and we take the tour. And the first thing on the tour is the steps in The Exorcist, which were filmed. And it's part of Georgetown
University. You were triggered.
I was triggered. I said, this isn't a good thing. There's something. This isn't right. This just isn't right.
So it is interesting, that whole list. There are things like that from the Exorcist, the head spinning, the green vomit, that are to this day made jokes of and are used in skits, and
that's
everybody
right.
sort of gets it. And you
that's
know,
right.
here's Johnny from The Shining. And some movies have that and some don't, even in the successful group. You know, it's really
that's
interesting.
That's very true, yeah.
Interesting stuff. Let's talk about a couple of other things. There's a movie called Ghost in the Shell.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen this movie. Mm-hmm. Very controversial for its casting.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Japanese thing based on an anime thing,
yes.
is that right? And they cast Scarlett Johansson,
yes.
this very famous non-Japanese actress.
Yes.
They paid her somewhere between $10 and $12 million, and they have lost their shirts
yes.
on this movie. I mean, there's a piece in Deadline magazine about it's estimated that they've lost somewhere between $60 and $100
yeah.
million dollars
yeah.
on this movie.
Yeah.
How does this happen?
Well, you know, what do they say about failure? I guess failure is an orphan, but really failure has many, many parents. And I think in this case, the casting, it's really difficult to prove whether or not the casting was the problem, but it sure didn't help. And it led to, it's funny, we've just been living through this Pepsi ad debacle over the last day or two, where the social media backlash to this Pepsi ad just utterly destroyed them. And I think that the casting controversy around casting Scarlett Johansson in a role that many people thought properly should go to an actress of Japanese descent created kind of a social media negativity that they just couldn't overcome. I think, but it's also a very niche. You know, I mean, I think that this Ghost in the Shell was a 1995 anime movie that really pushed the medium forward in many, many ways, and it was hugely influential to a whole generation of filmmakers, especially the Wachowski siblings, who literally copped a lot of stuff from the original cartoon to make The Matrix and other films. And it's taken this long, it's taken over 20 years to make the live-action remake, and during which time a lot of that imagery and those ideas have been recycled into other movies that have been really cool.
Like Ex Machina.
Exactly, Ex Machina a couple of years ago, which is just brilliant. So I think that the wow factor has dissipated. And there just wasn't, you know, it's still a cult movie. I mean, I just don't think it had broad enough awareness or appeal to make people, you know, hundreds of millions of people feel like they just had to see it. So I think there were a lot of factors that led to I mean, I will say, you know, all of that said, it's a very beautiful movie. I mean, it was directed by this guy named Rupert Sanders, who did Snow White and the Huntsman with Kristen Stewart a few years ago. And, you know, visually, he really knows how to put together a beautiful package. Mm-hmm. And I think Scarlett Johansson does her best in a role that, you know, still doesn't seem quite right for her. But it really calls on her performances in things like Her and Lucy and Under the Skin, where
they spent $250 million on this movie making it, and that's, you know,
they overspent.
That's a big bet on a movie.
Yeah, exactly. And it was way too, you know. And other people, like in the Deadline article, they pointed to the fact that one of the parent studios, which is Paramount, has been undergoing this kind of corporate executive upheaval, so there was really nobody to steer the ship, and that's how you get those overruns and that kind of loss of focus and direction.
Here's a clip from a movie that stars three terrific actors: Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin. This is from Going in Style.
You're taking your house and you didn't tell us?
What are you going to do, lend me money? These banks practically destroyed this country. They crushed a lot of people's dreams, and nothing ever happened to them. We're three old guys. We hit a bank. We get away with it. We retire with dignity. Worst comes to the worst. We get caught. We get a bed, three meals a day, and better health care than we get now.
So Jed Dietz, I mean, when you cast three, you know, icons like these guys, Freeman, Kane, and Arkin, there's a certain expectation that there's a certain niche that's going to go see this, regardless of what the plot is, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And this is a remake of a 1979 movie that Martin Brest made with three other icons, Art Carney and Lee Strasberg and George Burns, which I love. I mean, I haven't seen it in years, but I just love that movie. And Anne has seen this, and it sounds like this has got that kind of charm. So, yeah, there's a whole other kind of bet really based on these icons.
Mm-hmm. But not a movie that's going to do, like, great in China and great in India and stuff. I mean,
probably not. Comedies do tend to be kind of, you know, they're local in terms of national, you know, cultures and things like that. But there is an audience for this, and it's no masterpiece, but it's very genial and very warm-hearted, and the chemistry between those three guys is utterly delightful. It's just wonderful, and it's that kind of movie that you sort of chuckle gently throughout, you know? I mean, it doesn't overreach. Yes, there are a few kind of cheap slapsticky jokes. Yes, there's a few kind of cheap slapsticky sight gags, but it's a very pleasant movie-going experience, and I think that, like Jed said, there is definitely a target audience for this that I think will really be gratified
by it. Three artists like that.
No, you really
attention
can't argue with
must
that.
Must be paid.
Indeed. Yeah, and they all just play it beautifully. Yeah. They're just gorgeous.
Anne Hornaday is the film critic of The Washington Post. She's got a book coming out in June. It's called Talking Pictures. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. They'll be moving to their new digs at the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Parkway at the end of this month. And on Friday, April 28th, we're going to move into the Parkway for a special live broadcast. That's the Friday before the Maryland Film Festival begins its annual smorgasbord of films from around the world. And we're going to broadcast a special edition of the Movie Mayhem live from the Parkway. Jed will be there. Anne will be there. Steve Ziger, who designed the building, will be there. We'll have folks from the Hopkins and Mica film programs. Matt Porterfield, a filmmaker. It's going to be a great afternoon. You are welcome to join us, and you will get a sneak peek at the Parkway, the new home of the Maryland Film Festival. So again, it's Friday, April 28th at noon. Tickets are free, but you got to have a reservation, which are available on a first-come, first-served basis. So come to WIPR.org, and we'll shoot you a link, and you can see Jed and Ann and me and some very special guests for this live broadcast of the midday Movie Mayhem from the Parkway Theater, which Mr. Dietz can assure us will be finished in time.
It will be.
It will be. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Thanks, you guys. We'll see you at the end of the month. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Great. Thanks.
Our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, is up next with her weekly review. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.